is the Talking Tigers podcast, presented by the Alabama Department of Public Health. Don't wait. Vaccinate. Protect yourself and others by staying current on all vaccines, including respiratory virus vaccines. Visit alabamapublichealth.gov/IMM to learn more. Here's the voice of the Tigers, Andy Burcham, with this week's Talking Tigers podcast.
He was politely asked to leave two different schools before he settled on a career in the Army. Josh Wetzel came from a family of grandfathers, uncles, and his father that served this country. While in Afghanistan, he stepped on an improvised explosive device and lost both legs. He still wanted to go back and serve with his unit. While at Walter Reed, the lifelong Auburn fan felt this family reach out to him. After 2 years of treatment, he came to the Plains and earned his bachelor's degree. Wetzel now works in Auburn Athletics as the Assistant Director of Social Media Strategy. On this Veterans Day, Josh Wetzel tells his Auburn story in this Talking Tigers podcast presented by Alabama Public Health. Welcome into the Talking Tigers podcast. Very glad to have back with us, but the first time that we've been able to do this with War Eagle Plus, Josh Wetzel, who's Auburn's Assistant Director of Social Media Strategies, joins us today on this. And as this podcast airs for the first time today, it is Veterans Day. And you will understand, if you don't know this story already, why it is important for Josh to be with us today. War Eagle.
War Eagle, glad to be here.
How many years now for you at Auburn, Josh?
I'm in my eighth year now.
How about that?
Time flies when you're having fun.
You've made a life, though, in Auburn, haven't you?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Where was home for you?
Originally from Glencoe, Alabama. Northeast Alabama, outside of Gadsden.
Okay. Baseball player?
Yeah, played baseball my entire life. Played a little junior college baseball at Young Harris College and, you know, got politely asked to leave when, you know, I wasn't doing the school side of things. And, yeah.
Position?
If I was a middle infielder, I was pretty small. It's like 5'7", 145 pounds. And then went to college and hit that freshman 45. Moved over to the hot corner for that year, which was, I mean, it was a great move for me. But
when that occurs, though, and as you mentioned, you're politely asked to leave, what is your next step at that point, Josh? I'm sure you thought, hey, I'm going to play junior college baseball, and that's going to lead me to a scholarship somewhere else.
Or right.
Even more.
So right.
When that ends, what's the next step for you?
You know, I tried school. I tried to get things back together. I moved back home after a year at Young Harris College, and went to Gadsden State Community College for a couple semesters. Got my grades pretty okay. They weren't great, but I got them good enough to try to go to a four-year school, and then went to the University of North Alabama for about a year. But, you know, once I moved off again, like, my grades started going off. I started, you know, hanging out with the wrong crowd and not going to class, and just didn't really have a whole lot of discipline in my life at that time. And again, you know, I got put on academic probation, so they politely asked me to leave again. And that was when I realized I needed to do something different with my life.
What were your options at that point?
I didn't really know. Like, I could, my stepdad worked for the Parks and Rec Department where I grew up, and could have just worked there if I wanted to, but I knew that I kind of wanted something more, right? My dad was in the military, served in Desert Storm. You know, I was born in Germany, in Frankfurt, Germany. I don't remember anything about it. We moved back to the States when I was still, I think, a year old. I moved to El Paso, Texas, lived there until I was in first grade, and that's when I moved to Alabama. And so the military was, you know, a big part of my early childhood, and I have, you know, seven uncles who were also in the military. Both of my grandfathers were in the military, so it's kind of a, you know, family business.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd played around with the idea of maybe doing law enforcement, but, you know, at that time, really, the only option was going to be the military.
Why the Army?
My dad was in the Army, and I knew that, you know, I wanted to go and, you know, like, I knew the Army would be comfortable, right? I mean, as comfortable as it can be, I understood it. And, you know, I wanted to go, you know, I've seen all the commercials, be all you can be in the Army, you know, and I thought I was going to be, you know, just this high speed, you know, door kicker, you know, like the front of the line guys, and that's what I wanted to do. And so you know, I knew going in I could get called an 18 X-ray contract, which is, you know, it's a, they start you out, you go through infantry basic training and airborne school, and then you go and you start like special forces selection. And
where was boot camp for you?
All my basic training in airborne school at Fort Benning, and then selection at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
When did you find out that you were going to be shipped out?
Yeah, so, I mean, at the time I went in, like, it was Afghanistan and Iraq were both, you know, still pretty highly contested areas, you know, and so I knew, you know, whatever unit I went to, you know, when I went to selection, I went through selection, passed, went through language school, and then, you know, failed a run along the way, and if you, you know, fail one of your steps, like, they just kind of wash you into a regular infantry unit. And so I knew at that moment, like, they were going to put me in needs of the Army, which is, you know, they're usually going to put you into a unit that's getting ready to deploy. And so I knew as soon as I got my orders to Fort Lewis in Washington, like, I knew that they were, you know, pretty close to deploying if I'm not already deployed.
Did you know exactly what you would be doing at this point?
Honestly, I had no idea. And it's kind of funny, like, I had never really left the Southeast. So moving out to Fort Lewis was a huge culture shock for me. You know, me and my wife, Paige, we just picked up everything we owned and drove across the country, moved out there, and had no idea what to expect. I was kind of, you know, at that point, I was a little defeated because I, you know, I thought Special Forces was going to be my thing. And you know, I don't like failure a whole lot, even though that, you know, school wasn't really my thing. Like, I hate failure, and I'm really competitive, and that was kind of that culture, that special operations culture, and I thought I fit well in that, and so I was kind of defeated. But when I got into my unit, like, I knew I was right where I needed to be, because, I mean, right away, you know, they were coming back from, you know, a two-week training exercise, and you know, I met a lot of the guys. They were all like younger guys, and they kind of accepted me with open arms. And I knew the leadership that I had, they were incredible, and they were going to get me ready for anything that I could come across in Afghanistan.
How long had you been married?
Not very long at all. So I got married in 2010, in December 2010, and then moved to Fort Lewis, Washington in like August of 2011, a little over a year.
Athletics was part of the family, though. I mean, you played baseball. Paige played volleyball.
Right? Oh, yeah. Paige played volleyball at Jacksonville State. And so, like, even when I was going through my training and stuff, like, on my, like, off weekends, like, I would come down here and watch her. They, you know, her senior year, they won the conference championship, made it to the second round of the NCAA tournament, which for a school like Jacksonville State is a really big deal. Right. And athletics was just kind of in our blood and part of our life, big part of our lives.
How tough do you think it was for Paige to, as you mentioned, pick up and move across the country where at that point, other than the unit you're in, you guys don't know anyone?
Right. Yeah. I'll be honest with you. Like, I've talked to her about it a few times. And, you know, when we made the decision to move both of us out there, because I knew when I was going out there, like, I wasn't going to be there for long. I was going to get there, probably do a few months of training and then deploy, which is what ended up happening. But we got married and we didn't live together right off the bat because she was a graduate assistant at Jacksonville State at that time. And I was going through training and didn't really know kind of, you know, where I was going to be. And so we didn't move in together right off the bat, right when we got married. And so she was just like, she knew that when I got orders to Fort Lewis, nothing was going to stop her from going out there with me. And so I know it was probably hard for her to go out there because, I mean, it was a culture shock for both of us. She's never been outside of Fort Payne, Alabama. And then we're, you know, picking up everything we own, which is not a lot. It fit into a very small U-Haul trailer, moved all the way across the country. But, you know, as soon as we got there, we fell in love with the area and the mountains. And I mean, growing up in Northeast Alabama, you think, you know, we live on the mountain. And turns out those are just hills compared to the mountains out west. It's just kind of funny.
How long were you there before you were deployed?
Not very long. So I got there in August, and we deployed in at the end of March. So it was a pretty quick turnaround.
As you mentioned, you were accepted right off the bat by your unit. That's not a guarantee,
right?
Is it?
No, it's not. The infantry specifically, I mean, they're very, you kind of have to earn your way through right. things. And I felt like they kind of looked at the training that I'd been through already, and they knew that, you know, just to make it through Special Forces selection, you got to have, you know, a certain level of either crazy or toughness. And I think they saw it as toughness, which was good. And so, you know, as soon as I got there, they thrust me into leadership position, and you know, all the guys that I oversaw were incredible. They loved me, and we had fun.
What's your rank at this point?
That time I was just an E4 specialist. They knew that, you know, part of that was like, as an E4, you either come in as an E4 because you have a college degree, or you have been in for a certain amount of time. And so they knew I didn't have a college degree, so they knew I had at least had a little experience with the military.
You mentioned you were not real disciplined, especially when it came to the academic side.
Oh, yeah.
In junior college and at North Alabama.
Right.
You really don't have a choice, though, if you're moving on to the Army at that point, though, do you?
No, you don't. And I honestly, like, when I first told people I was going into the military, like, I had a lot of people, even my family, that were like, I don't know if this is something you can do. Like, you have trouble waking up for an 8 o'clock class, and you're gonna have to be at PT at 5 a.m. How are you gonna do this? And to be honest, like, going into the Army, like, is kind of crazy. Like, just the mindset change that I had. Obviously, you come in, and as soon as you go into basic training, they, you know, it's like drinking water out of a fire hydrant, and they're just beating discipline into you every single day. But then it's like, you know, if you take all the craziness out of it, like, you're just out there with all your friends and you're all doing the same thing. And like, you know, whether it's hard or easy or whatever, like, you're all doing it together. And so for me, that was easy because, like, I grew up on teams my entire life. And so anything my team's doing, like, I know I can do because I got everybody around me and all my brothers around me. And so the discipline actually became easier when I started looking at it that way.
For those that are listening or watching or both this podcast that have been in a branch of the service, my guess is they understand that closeness, that cohesive factor. Perhaps for those of us that played a team sport to a certain degree,
yeah,
we understand that.
For sure.
How important is that, though, in what you are about to start to do as you were deployed, to be in that cohesive, and I'm not even sure that's the proper word,
yeah,
to describe that unit that you were in?
Yeah, no, it was super important. A couple months after I got there, we got the orders to where we were going to go, and where we were was just outside of Kandahar, Afghanistan, and I love history. And so, you know, the first thing I did was just looking up the history of Kandahar, and I knew, like, kind of how hotly contested that area was. Kandahar is a religious hotbed for them. It's where the birthplace of the Taliban was. And so I knew right off the bat that it was gonna be a pretty tough deployment. And where we were, like, we didn't have a lot of advantages. The cohesion of the unit was huge. I joke around all the time, I call it trauma bonding. Like, we trained really, really hard because we wanted to be the best. And you have to train really hard when you're going into those situations because, you know, it's not, you know, it's a little different from being on, like, a sports team in the fact, like, if somebody's not having a good day on a sports team, you just may lose a game. Whereas if somebody's not having a good day in the military or on a deployment, somebody might lose their life. You know, I was 25, 26 years old. I would say like I was one of the older guys, not the oldest by far, but I was one of the older guys on the team. And like, I had guys that on my team that were 18, 19 years old and hadn't really experienced life. And like, I kind of understood more than they did, like, how fine of a line that was. And so, you know, like our first sergeant and all of our command, they put us through really, really tough training so we could understand everything that we were doing as well as we could. And then on top of that, like, my team, like, we did extra training just to make sure, like, we're close, you know, and we trauma bonded and mm-hmm. we grew really close together.
How large of a group are we talking about, Josh?
So my team, I oversaw, we kind of weren't like a traditional like infantry line unit. Like usually you have like 3 to 4 squads with 2 teams each. My squad was just a gun squad. So I had 2 machine gunners, me and our medic, and then our forward observer, which forward observer usually he's the one that talks to the like air support and then like the mortars and stuff like that, controls all that. And so I kind of oversaw that. It wasn't a traditional line unit. And so, yeah.
What's your role?
Yeah, I was their team leader, which, being their team leader didn't mean a whole lot. Like, I was in charge of them, and if they messed up, it fell on me. But, like, we were kind of all one and the same. Like, I carried the machine gun for a while in Afghanistan. I kind of all switched out in different roles.
I hesitate to ask this next question because it will sound very simple, and what you did was not simple. What was for lack of a better phrase, what was a typical day? Like typical day or night, like for you?
Yeah, in Afghanistan, where we were, our main threat was improvised explosive devices, which usually consisted of like 2 pieces of wood with some kind of foam in the middle of them, and then like 2 connectors that ran off to a battery and an explosive. So when you stepped on it, it basically completed the circuit and would ignite the explosive. Everywhere we went, like we learned very early on in Afghanistan, like we were a striker unit. So we had these big, beautiful trucks. They had, 8 wheels, they're armored, like they're amazing. They were incredible in Iraq. In Afghanistan, they weren't as incredible because of all the IEDs that were in the area. And so we learned pretty quickly, we go out in strikers, we're probably going to hit an IED. So we stopped taking our strikers out. But then, we had to deal with the IEDs by foot, right? And so everywhere we went like ducks in a row behind a metal detector. And first, few weeks into the deployment, we're trying to figure out like who's gonna man this metal detector. And I don't have a healthy fear of anything. And so, of course, like when that opportunity arose, like I like leading things from the front. I like being in the front. I don't like being in the back. And I volunteered for that, and my platoon sergeant was like, look, you're gonna have to like get proficient at this. And so like for like a week solid, I would work with our improvised explosive, our EOD team, something ordnance disposal. I worked with them really closely on how to be proficient with that metal detector and what I'm looking for. And they had like different, they call them like lanes, where you like go out and you try to find things that they've put out there and identify things that, are normal things when there's an IED in the area. And I learned a lot in a really short amount of time. And so I ended up being the one that led all the patrols. And so from that point forward, it was like ducks in a row behind me every single day. And every day we left our COP, we were out in a very, rural area. So where we were was like not in the mountains of Afghanistan, but we were more in the desert of Afghanistan. So it was like moon dust everywhere. And there were very incredibly poor communities. Like everybody lived in like mud houses with like, it was like very like primitive almost. They didn't have any electricity, no running water. Some of them had like little motorcycles and stuff like that, but that they just ride from town to town. But for the most part, it was very like a primitive area. Some people had like generators or things like that, but that was very rare. Every time we'd leave our base, we'd go out and we'd patrol through little towns surrounding us. And every single day we would take some sort of small arms fire. It kind of got to where it was like a normal thing. It usually wasn't like you see in the movies, right, where you're just getting hundreds of people shooting at you. A lot of times it was just like pop shots to get us to move somewhere because they understood our tactics. So like if they shoot us, we're going to go investigate it a lot of the times, right? And so that's kind of, what every day was like in Afghanistan.
The metal detector that you're using, is this a military-grade metal detector?
It's funny you ask that. No, it wasn't. I think they did get, it was, it was better than your normal, like, one you could go get from Walmart and go out on a beach with.
Right.
Not much better than that. But they did get, after I got injured, they got much better equipment.
It's a great day to get vaccinated. Many children and adults that delayed vaccination during the pandemic are still behind schedule. It is crucial that we take the steps to get everyone back on track with their routine immunizations. Children and teens can still catch up on their vaccinations even if they start late. Make sure you and your family are up to date on all recommended vaccines, including respiratory virus vaccines. Let's all do our part to get back on track. Don't wait. Vaccinate. For more information, visit alabamapublichealth.gov/IMM.
Can you take us through the day?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were on, I think, day two of what was going to be a three-day patrol. So in the weeks leading up to this particular patrol, we were basically started in the western side of our area of operations, and we were basically pushing everything from the west side to the east side. So it was, you know, a couple of weeks worth of operations, and like different groups from our company would go out at a time and, like, you know, kind of help out another base unit, whatever, and just keep pushing people to the east.
How wide of a swath are we talking about?
Not super huge. It's probably, I would imagine, somewhere like, you know, 30 miles by 30 miles, something like that. Okay. Square. But basically how, you know, we would basically all patrol in a line, you know, from north to south and move through towns, whatever, clear everything, clear all the bad guys out and everything like that. And, you know, we had gotten up to our area, which was the farthest east. We were on day two of that operation and we were way ahead of schedule. We were moving really fast and things were going really well. And we, you know, we're kind of going, it was about midday. It's like 115 degrees out there. It's much different than it is here. Like, it's, that's a very dry heat out there. I'd much rather deal with 115 degrees there than 98 degrees here because, you know, the humidity. But we were moving really well, and we had some guys that were dealing with some heat issues, so we had to, like, switch some equipment around. And so, like, the guy that was normally behind me wasn't behind me. Our lead sniper was behind me, and we had, you know, switched some things around. And we were moving along, and I knew exactly where we were because we had been there, you know, hundreds of times before, and I knew the exact route I needed to take to go where I was going. And we were basically walking up next to a wall. The wall was probably 8 feet tall, 8 to 10 feet tall, so we couldn't see over it. And I knew on the other side of there was like a little compound, like three houses that were there. And the nicest family in the world lived there. They were super happy to see us every time we came, but they weren't out playing, which was, you know, a little bit weird. And they had kids who weren't out in the fields, which was a little bit weird. And the wall's on my left side, and we're walking along the wall, and I'm sweeping, and in front of us is a dirt road. And every single time I go across this road, like, I pick a different spot in the road to go to, because they learn as they watch us and how we move and everything like that. And so, you know, for example, like, you know, as Americans, we're pretty lazy. And so, like, if we're going to go over a wall, we're going to find usually a low spot in the wall and go to that low spot in the wall. Well, you know, that's where they bury IEDs. Well, we had gotten so good at finding them and clearing them that they had just stopped putting them there, because we would target that low spot, find it, clear it, get it blown up, get it moved out of the area, which, you know, in turn made the locals happy. But so we're coming up to this road, and I'm kind of moving, the wall ends, and so I'm moving in a way where I can see on the other side of the wall as I'm coming to the road. And I noticed that on my left, across the road, there's two lines of rocks going across the dirt road, which is, it's not normal. Right. And usually that means there's something in the area, because the, you know, the Taliban, they try to, like, warn the locals, hey, stay out of this area. Something's going to go down, you know. And so, you know, I radio back to my platoon sergeant. I'm like, hey, I'm going to take a little bit more time going across the road today. You know, I got two lines of rocks. I don't really know what's going on, but just want to make sure everybody's all right. And he's like, yep, cool with that. So I clear the road. We mark two sides. We mark it with shaving cream because it just kind of goes away pretty quickly, but everybody can see it and we can get everybody across the road. And then so after that, we're going across a field, and immediately across this field, the field's probably, I'd say, 20 yards across. And immediately after the field was like a mud wall, and it's pretty beat up, like mud wall, and they have like grape hedges everywhere, so they basically build up the dirt and they grow the grapes on top and they flood the fields, and then the grapes kind of, the vines grow down into the little openings. And on the other side of that wall was just a great bunch of grape rows. So, you know, like I had normally been doing, I went to that low spot in the wall because I was like, if there's something here, it's probably going to be in this low spot in the wall. And I'll find it, we'll clear it, it'll be good. So I go over to the low spot in the wall and I'm clearing, you know, and everywhere. And I clear, you know, about 6 feet on either side just in case somebody starts shooting at us. You know, we've got at least some cover where some of our guys can go. As I'm coming back to the low spot, I reach across to basically clear the other side, because if we're going to hop over, I want to go ahead and have a path cleared out. And as I reach across is when I stepped on it. Boom. I can remember flying through the air. I can remember the moment it happened. It was the weirdest thing. It was like almost like an out-of-body experience, but I can remember myself like lifting off the ground. I can remember, I joke around all the time. Like I said, I don't have a healthy fear of anything. So at no point in that day did I ever fear dying. But so I stepped on it. I can remember flying through the air. I remember seeing sky, ground, sky, and then I hit the ground. And as soon as I hit the ground, like I knew something bad was probably, you know, it was not good, right? The day before, we had a guy in another unit just a little bit further south of us that had stepped on an IED, and he had lost both of his legs pretty high, and I knew it probably wasn't going to be good. So I didn't look down there. I kind of gave myself, like, you know, my arms and once over. I looked at my right arm. I had a little like area on my right arm that was bleeding pretty bad, but nothing serious. My left middle finger was partially amputated, and so I was like, I'm not going to look at that anymore because that's gross. You know, at that point, you know, I'm just, you know, thinking, like, what the heck am I going to do now?
Is there any kind of sound when that occurred?
I've had doctors that tell me, like, if you didn't hear a sound, it probably knocked you out. But, like, I can vividly remember flying through the air, but I never heard a sound.
Who's the first one that tends to?
My medic, who was also one of my best friends. And, you know, laying on the ground, as soon as I checked myself out, and the next thing I thought, like, what am I going to do? And then I was thinking, how am I going to calm him down? Because he's normally like a shaky guy in real life. And I mean, you can imagine, like, I know that he's able to see me in the patrols anywhere I go. And so I knew he probably watched me step on it, or at least, you know, part of it. And so I'm just thinking, like, how am I going to calm him down? Because, like, he's shaky in real life. I don't want him working on me if he's extra shaky. I mean, watch your best friend step on IED. That's hard. And then you got to go try and save his life. That's even harder. And so I just, you know, like I said, I don't have a healthy fear of anything. Never once feared dying. And so as soon as he gets to me, he's working on me. He's one of the best medics I've ever met in my life. He's still in now. He just, you know, he just extended to finish his career in the military, and he's doing great. But, you know, he's going through all of his checks. He's starting with my head and moving his way down. He's starting to put tourniquets on me. And I'm like, I stop him. I'm like, hey, stop. And he's like, what? And I was like, did you see that sick flip that I just did? And he's like, what? No, shut up, man. Like, come on. And he starts working on me again. I was like, no, seriously. Like, did you see it? Like, if I had feet, I would have landed that. And he was like, how'd you know you didn't have feet? And I was like, you just answered the question for me, so I appreciate it. But yeah, I would have landed that if I had feet.
He saved your life.
He did. He's absolutely saved my life. Like I said, I never feared dying, and like I didn't realize how close to dying I was until after I got back to Walter Reed and we saw like the medical reports and everything.
Where did they take you?
After they, you know, strapped me in and like made sure I was okay and everything, sent me to Kandahar first, which is about 45-minute helicopter flight. And after that, that was kind of where they kind of take you in stages, right? So they stabilize you enough to get you to the next area. And so like Kandahar, they stabilized me enough to get me to Kabul, and from Kabul to Germany, and then from Germany to Walter Reed Hospital in DC.
It's a great day to get vaccinated. Many children and adults that delayed vaccination during the pandemic are still behind schedule. It is crucial that we take the steps to get everyone back on track with their routine immunizations. Children and teens can still catch up on their vaccinations even if they start late. Make sure you and your family are up to date on all recommended vaccines, including respiratory virus vaccines. Let's all do our part to get back on track. Don't wait. Vaccinate. For more information, visit alabamapublichealth.gov/IMM.
What is the call like to Paige?
She's actually still got the voicemail on her phone. She still listens to it every now and then, but she was getting ready for work. She was still at Fort Lewis in Washington. She was working at a before and after school, like YMCA thing. So she was getting ready for school and got a call from a number that she didn't know, and she didn't answer it, and it went to voicemail. And when she got the voicemail, it was basically somebody from the United States Army, and was like, "Hey, I need you to give me a call back at this number." And
that's got to be a chilling call to receive.
Yeah. She said like as soon as she heard that, like she just like fell to the floor, and she knew like something was wrong. Mm.
When did you talk to or see her for the first time after the explosion?
Apparently, I talked to her when I was in Germany, but I was pretty heavily medicated in Germany, so I don't really remember that. My mom actually flew and met me in Germany. Okay. Paige didn't have a passport at the time, so she couldn't come. So my mom, being a nurse, she flew out there, met me there, and we FaceTimed. But the first time I remember seeing her was when maybe 10 minutes after I got to Walter Reed Hospital. They basically, wheeled me off the plane. They took me in the truck to Walter Reed, from the truck to the ICU unit. It was like 10 minutes after I'd been there, and she came walking in the door. And as soon as I saw her, I just started like boo-hooing crying. And she was like, why are you crying right now? And I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And she was like, why are you sorry? And she was like, I was just like floored. Like, you don't see this, you know? I was like, I lost my legs. And she looked me dead in the eye. I'll never forget it. She looked me dead in the eye and said, well, we know where they're at. We're just not going to go back and get them. And that kind of set the tone for the rest of my recovery.
That's remarkable. When does Auburn come into the picture for you, Josh?
Pretty quickly. So, when you get injured, like everybody from your hometown hears about it. And we had started a Facebook page to kind of update my family. I have a huge family. And so instead of making 1,000 calls to update everybody every day on my condition, they created a Facebook page, which turned into, 19,000 people following this Facebook page. And
it's a big family.
It's a big family. And people just sent stuff like clothes or, cards, whatever, and ended up having like every Auburn poster that you could ever have. So like my wall was pretty much, in my room was pretty much like wallpapered and nothing but Auburn posters, and like people sent me Auburn shirts. And of course, like every day in physical therapy, like I'm gonna wear my Auburn clothes, because that's, it's all I got, And so
what year is this, Josh?
This was 2012. So I got injured on May 31st, 2012, and I was back in the United States June 5th, 2012. And so I'd say probably by the end of June, like people were calling me and asking like, what are my plans after the military? And at that point, like I didn't know I was getting out of the military. People kind of understood I probably wasn't going to get to stay in the Army. But for some reason, I thought even with no legs, like I was going to get to go back. And pretty early on, Auburn got involved.
Had you been an Auburn person before?
Yeah, no, I grew up an Auburn fan. working at Auburn, we don't have many people that grew up Auburn fans. We have a lot of implants. And so, like, I can vividly remember, like, my senior year of high school watching the 2004 team. It's funny because we get to, you know, celebrate that 20-year anniversary right. this year. And, you know, I grew up an Auburn fan.
Okay. How long is that recovery at Walter Reed?
The recovery part of it wasn't terribly long. So, like, I got injured in May, and I was on my legs by December, on my prosthetic legs. I wasn't walking great. Like, there was still a lot of, like, physical therapy and stuff I had to do, but I was at Walter Reed a little under 2 years, actually a little more than 2 years. So I'd say probably the recovery part of it, early on, I was in and out of surgery every other day, either like repairing something or cleaning wounds out or something. So it was like every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I was in surgery. And that probably went on for, 3 months maybe. And then it was physical therapy and occupational therapy, learning how to walk again, getting my strength back. It's amazing because I watch videos of my physical therapy early on, and I was so weak when I first got injured, part of my physical therapy was sitting on one of those inflatable discs and learning how to balance again, just sitting there. And I was booping a balloon back and forth with my occupational therapist. And then, that moved into, actually working on strengthening those muscles and then learning how to walk again and getting fitted for those prosthetics and making sure that they're ready to go. And so in all, the recovery aspect of it was probably a year and a half, maybe.
When are you thinking about, all right, what's next in my life? Not all right, I've got prosthetic legs, I'm going to learn how to walk again, mm-hmm. but what's the next step in my life at this point?
I didn't think about it for the first maybe 3 or 4 months. I was in the hospital. Like I said, for some reason, I thought that I was going to be able to stay in the military and do exactly what I was doing before. Obviously, being heavily medicated kind of aided in that, but I can remember the day, somebody came in, and was talking to me and was like, hey, so you've got a couple of options. Obviously, you can't be in the infantry anymore, but if you want to stay in the military, we can try to figure out what that looks like. And I don't remember any more of the conversation after that. I had no idea what that person said to me. All I heard was I couldn't be in the infantry anymore. And I don't know why I never thought that wouldn't be an option anymore, but that broke my heart. And it was that moment, I was I don't know what I'm going to do. School wasn't for me the first time. I don't like school. Even when I came back to Auburn, school still wasn't really for me. I don't like sitting in a class and learning. I like doing, right? And so I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew that I couldn't just go home and sit around and just not do anything, because it's not good when veterans do that. And so I didn't have any idea what I was going to do. And that's, luckily, I had people, involved in Auburn or that worked with Auburn. Kate Larkin and her daughter were very instrumental in getting me to Auburn. Her daughter just happened to be in D.C. and heard that there was an Auburn fan at Walter Reed, and she just wanted to bring me a shirt. And I don't remember it. I had just gotten out of surgery. She stopped by and left me a shirt. Paige wasn't in the room. She had left while I was sleeping. She came back. She was like, where did this shirt come from? I was like, no idea. And then Kate Larkin got involved, and she was incredible. And she wanted to bring me down for games and everything like that. And so, working with her and just talking with different people, I kind of started to,
At this point, Kate is working at the Alumni Center.
Yes, right. Yeah. She works at the Alumni Center at that time. At that point was, I started thinking maybe I can go to Auburn. Maybe I can finish my degree. I've got some, discipline now, so I can at least wake up for an 8 o'clock class. I can at least do my homework when I'm supposed to do it.
Paige is going to make sure that happens.
Yeah, oh yeah. Paige is going to be on me and make sure that happens. And
so you come to Auburn.
So I come to Auburn.
You've basically flunked out of junior college. You flunk out of North Alabama.
Yeah.
You go through all of this while in the Army. And now you're coming to Auburn to get your degree.
Yeah. Yep. I never once thought it would actually be possible. Like, I came in here with the 1.9 GPA, and I was laughing. I was at the Veterans Resource Gala recently, and President Chris Roberts was there, and I was actually telling this story, like, I don't even know how I got in here. And he was talking about how, you know, like, sometimes they look at veterans a little differently, you know, like maybe they've experienced some things in life and maybe changed a little bit, you know. But I was like, I have no idea. Like, a 1.9, it's hard to get into Auburn. And I came in with a 1.9 GPA.
But you made it through.
But I made it through. And I finished my degree. And I wouldn't say that I was the best student in the world, but I at least came to class. I sat on the front row. I did my homework when I was supposed to. Finished my degree in 2016.
And then what?
When I was in school, I, you know, realized pretty quickly that I needed something on my resume besides military stuff. Leadership only gets you so far. You need, like, practical experience to get real jobs. And so Paige was working at Point University at the time as the head volleyball coach there. And so I just asked if I could volunteer in their communications department. And at the time, Austin Penny was working there. He needed help. He was one SID for 18 sports. And so he was like, yes, please come, like, help any way you can. So I got a lot of really good experience there. And he kind of put me in touch. After a year with him, he put me in touch with Shelley Poe. And I came and volunteered as a student in the communications department here at Auburn. And it was the most incredible experience. Since I had a little bit of experience as an SID, they, you know, threw me into women's tennis. I was the main SID for women's tennis and loved that. Did, I think, a pretty good job. The coach liked me, so that was good. And
that's a big part of it.
That's a big part of it. Yeah. And, you know, I got a lot of really great experience. And, you know, as I was graduating, Kirk Sampson brought me into his office, and he was like, so we want to keep you here. And I was like, well, I appreciate that, because I was just going to, like, stay whether you paid me or not. Like, I was going to stay. And
how convenient.
Yeah. He was like, well, we've got two options. Like, we can either bring you on, you know, part-time right now till you get a little more experience, or we can bring you on as a graduate assistant. And you can verify this with him, but just looked him in the eye and I was like, Kirk, I'd rather clean toilets than go back to school. So, like, I would rather just do the part-time thing. So he hired me part-time right there.
Where do you live?
So we were very fortunate. There's an organization called Homes for Our Troops. And when we moved to Auburn, we kind of bounced around from, like, rental house to rental house, and Homes for Our Troops reached out to us and, you know, brought us on and said that they would like to build a house for us, buy land for us and build a house for us. And so in 2017, like, or 16, right after I graduated, we actually broke ground on a house just right on the Auburn Beauregard city limits right there. And
you're a Southsider.
Yeah, I'm a Southsider. They built us a mortgage-free home right there.
How many children?
I got two children.
Yeah.
Yep. Oldest is 11 now, which I can't believe. She's 11. And then youngest is 8, just turned 8.
It's remarkable that they've known this life with you as someone that has these legs that you take off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not the typical life of a kid.
No, it's not. We laugh about it quite a bit, actually, because that's all they've known is the amputee life. They didn't know Army Dad, even though Harper was born at Walter Reed Hospital. They didn't know Army Dad. And all they've known is, I have a lot of friends that are amputees that we still keep in touch with and do things with. And they just, it's just a normal thing to them.
I ask this question a lot of former student athletes on this podcast that have moved on in their life, how much they keep up with those teammates that they had at Auburn. How much do you keep up with that team that was deployed out of Washington?
Yeah.
And went through many things that most of us can't even imagine.
I try to keep up with them pretty regularly. I have one that lives just north of Atlanta that I see more than the rest of them. The rest of them kind of stayed out west. My platoon sergeant, he's actually a triple amputee. He stepped on an IED probably a month and a half after I did. I talked to him pretty regularly as well. And, you know, we're still all pretty close. I don't talk to him as much as I would like to or need to. You know, every time we do talk, it was like, you know, no time had passed. Like, we just pick up right where we left off.
How are you physically?
Great, physically. I honestly, like, right now I'm in the best shape of my life. For a long time, I didn't work out or anything, didn't exercise hardly at all. I focused on work, and that was it. And my health kind of started going down. I was in my legs less and less every day. And, you know, honestly, like, I joined a new gym, Iron Tribe, and they, you know, my coach there, Austin, he really has helped me, like, figure out things that I can do. And, you know, I joke around with him, like, I skipped leg day for 11 years before I joined that gym, and he expected me the first day to work out my legs. And so we've figured out how to work out my legs and really just kind of given me, like, that purpose again and something to strive for every day.
I've never asked you this question before, Josh. From a mental standpoint, how much do you deal with?
You know, honestly, that's a tough question. So for everybody, it's a little bit different, yeah. Right? You look at PTSD and people that are coming back from war and things that we've all seen and really hard things, right? You know, I don't deal with things as much. I try to keep a positive outlook on everything. Now, there are still times that, you know, like, things that haunt me and things that I deal with. You know, I remember, and I've never said this, you know, on a podcast or anything, but there was a day when I was in Afghanistan, you know, there was a guy and he was walking to our base and he was wearing, you know, like, full white clothing and he was carrying something and we didn't know what it was. We could see him coming from a long way away because we had cameras and everything. And he got to our gate, and as he got closer, I could tell he was carrying a little boy. I didn't know what happened, and I was a little skeptical at first because, you know, you see the movies and, you know, bad guys do bad things, right?
Right?
As he was getting closer, I could see it was a little boy, and I, you know, motioned him over, which is, you know, not really what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to, like, you know, he should have put down whatever he was carrying. Like, we check whatever he was carrying, make sure everything's good to go, right? Well, I motioned him over, and, like, as soon as he came over, like, he dropped his little boy into my arms. And basically what had happened is him and his son were working out in the fields, and I don't know what happened. I don't know if we even had a group out that day, but his son took a bullet to the head. And, like, that was a very tough moment for me because I can remember this little boy to this day. Like, I can see him very vividly. And so it's things like that that are tough, right?
Sure.
It's things like, you know, after I got injured, you know, my best friend got killed, my platoon sergeant got injured, and, like, up until I had gotten injured, nobody got injured. And so I dealt with a lot of, like, survivor's guilt with that. But honestly, like, I've been surrounded, like, my family's incredible, you know, from the day I got to Walter Reed. Like, they pushed me, they treated me like everything was normal, like, this was just going to be the normal, and we're going to figure out life, and we're going to go throughout it, you know. And I've done, you know, therapy and stuff, but honestly, like, I'm blessed. Like, I didn't have a healthy fear of anything, and so not a lot of things.
Has that changed?
No, not at all. Like, I still go, like, I'm a bull in a china shop at all times. But honestly, like, you know, the Lord's really blessed me with that. Like, I know a lot of guys that I deployed with that really struggle with some of that stuff.
Sure.
Even some of the same incidents that I went through. But I just try to, you know, look at it like, you know, that was a very hard situation, but I try to see the good that came through all of it, right? I wouldn't have ever come back to Auburn, I don't think, if I had not gotten injured. I don't know if I would have my kids right now if I had not gotten injured. I don't know my plan was to stay in the military, go back to, you know, the Special Forces qualification course and go into the special operations, and who knows where I would have been if I had actually done that, you know? And so, you know, I just try to look at everything like, you know, this was supposed to happen, you know, and I see the good at it. What somebody meant for evil, like, actually turned out to be pretty good for me, you know? Like, my marriage is great. I got two beautiful little girls who are incredible. I graduated from Auburn, which I never thought I would do. And now I get, like, they pay me to go to sporting events, which is not a bad deal at all.
When's the last time you wore long pants?
I don't actually own long pants anymore. The only time I wear pants now is the last two times I've done it were for both of my sister's weddings, okay. Only because they forced me to. And I, you know, I went down kicking and screaming like a toddler. I'm hoping my brother, when he gets married one day, will actually let me wear shorts, but it's not trending in a good direction right now.
It almost sounds cliche when I say this. I mean it with all my heart. Thank you for your service.
I appreciate you.
You tell a remarkable story, and I can't tell you how much I admire what you've done with your life since. And I thank you for being part of the podcast today.
I appreciate you having me. I love getting to sit down and talk to you. We've done this a couple of times now. We did a Friday football luncheon, and I love sitting down and talking with you.
I appreciate your time. Thank you. War Eagle.
Thank you. War Eagle.
For Josh Wetzel and the Talking Tigers podcast, brought to you by Alabama Public Health, I'm Andy Burcham. Be strong and be courageous. War Eagle.